Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. It's like Mark said, it's one of the benefits for me, as he said, you know, being adventurous, being a researcher, being a parent, the hybrid, along with the green tech aspects of it and being mindful of our impact on the environment. I think one of the things that I also want to note about the hybrid nature of this is how empowering it is for more people to be able to participate and accessibility. For me, always grateful when I can balance parenting with being present in my work community and the ability of hybrid events to be able to accommodate that. So I thank Eden for this option and that I'm able to Zoom in this morning. I'm going to chat for about 30 minutes or so. I know that I'm coming in fresh at the start of my day and everyone else is listening at the end of their day. So I'll present for about 30 minutes and then I'll have some time for Q&A. And I'll just talk a bit, first of all, where I'm at, because I'm presenting from my home. I do want to acknowledge that I live, work, and I enjoy leisure activities on the traditional, ancestral, unceded, shared territory of the Matsqui and Tsimeh First Nations, who are part of the Stolo Nation in the Fraser Valley of British Columbia. And they've lived in the Fraser Valley area for over 10,000 years. And it's critical as I, in my practice, that I acknowledge that I am an uninvited guest on these lands and that I am working to better understand the impact of colonialism, both in my local community and beyond across Canada and globally. So as Mark said, I wear a few hats. My primary hat is now as the executive director of the Canadian Digital Learning Research Association. And I've been the research lead for the National Survey of Online and Digital Learning since 2019. So it's been very interesting to watch the trends shift from our data pre-pandemic to what we're seeing now in the post. Oh, I like to think we're in the post-pandemic context. I don't think we're quite there yet, but when we're at this point, 2 years into the pandemic. I also work with Dr. George Valencianos at Royal Roads University in British Columbia, and he's a Canada Research Chair in Innovative Learning and Technology, and I've worked on a number of projects with him related to that role. And then I also work on independent research and consulting projects and currently working with Bayview Analytics, which is formerly the Babson Survey Research Group in the USA. And I'm also currently working on a project with WCET in the USA. So ultimately, my research interests, especially over the past couple years, have spanned pan-Canadian trends in digital learning. So we've been looking at changes over time, prevalence of different modes of learning. Of course, very interesting during the pandemic where everything switched online. And I'll talk a bit more about what that looked like in the Canadian context and how it was unique. Effective teaching practices and practices to support EDI. I've also been involved in studies that look at the future of higher education, looking at speculative futures, looking at hopes and anxieties about the future amongst faculty, and just trying to better understand, how we envision the future tell us about what we need to do now in the present. And the last thing that I've been working on in depth for about a couple of years now is just defining key terms related to digital learning, which has been in many ways opening a huge can of worms. I'm not going to go too much into that in this presentation. But one of the things that I think is important about the implications of the pandemic and bringing so many more people into the room to talk about digital learning is we particularly at the institutional level, amongst faculty, amongst administrators, we see the word online learning being used, And yet we've found that there's many different meanings attached to it. So when two people are talking about online learning, we can't necessarily assume that they're meaning the same thing, even though they're using the same word in conversation with one another. So one of the things I'll start with here is just leading into the fact of what we know is that the pandemic will have a lasting impact on teaching and learning. So since the start of the pandemic, I've been involved in, I've lost count at this point, but about 10 to 15 different studies, just investigating the impact on faculty, on students, particularly in the Canadian and US contexts. And what we see really clearly in the data is that, we know that faculty and students gained experience teaching and learning in an online setting, and it was experience that they didn't have before. For some, that was a positive experience. For some, it was not so much. What's unique in the Canadian context is the majority of post-secondary institutions in Canada, we went online, as it did much of the world, in March of 2020. However, the decision was made at most post-secondary institutions in September of 2020 to do that entire academic year, the 2020-2021 academic year, fully online for the most part. So our faculty in Canada had about 18 months of online teaching and learning experience. And while I would refer to it as emergency remote learning in terms of what happened in March of 2020, I'm hesitant to call what was happening in September of 2020 and that academic year emergency remote teaching. Yes, it may have been offered in person or on campus if the pandemic wasn't there, but at the same time, it was well planned. Canadian institutions had a lot of instructional designers coming in. They invested heavily in faculty professional development over the summer months. So in Canada in particular, faculty had the opportunity to really go into that school year feeling more confident. And we saw that in our findings and data that faculty felt much more confident about teaching online going forward. So when I refer to online learning in Canada during the pandemic, I do that intentionally rather than using the word emergency remote teaching, because I think it's important to acknowledge that the teaching that happened was well planned and well supported, and it was thought through and done in a strategic way. It wasn't perfect, but given the circumstances, it was well done. What we saw because of that, and we see this in both, particularly in both Canada and the US, but there was a shift in attitude toward teaching online. So that some, this lasting impact prior to the pandemic, there were those of us who've been heavily involved in the world of online teaching and learning. I know for myself, I did all my graduate studies, both my master's degree and PhD work remotely. However, that was more the exception than the norm. And prior to the pandemic, there were more negative attitudes towards teaching online, whereas that seems to be shifting. And I would say it has shifted. What we saw as well is, while there were certainly some faculty who and students who were eager to go back to in-person learning, we also saw faculty and students who may not have tried online learning prior to the pandemic, but actually found that it was a great fit for them. And, some faculty who are saying, well, now that I've done it, I actually would like to continue to teach at least some courses online or in a hybrid format going forward. One of the key things that we saw was that there were changes to instructional practices. So we saw in the data that, this to me is a real indicator that the pandemic's going to have a lasting impact on teaching and learning, is that faculty were reporting that even when they could go back to teaching in person and this study was conducted during the pandemic, during that shift to online, that their teaching practices were going to be changed, that they would teach differently based on what they had learned during the pandemic, and that they would be, even in an in-person setting, changing how they taught. And we see that, we saw that in some of the qualitative comments that surrounded that was, for some faculty, this was an opportunity. Not all faculty have, you know, training in how to teach, but because, especially in Canada, with the shift and the long-term, you know, teaching and learning online, we had to have, you know, the professional development was necessary, and faculty gained skills for teaching and learning. And lastly, we see changes to assessment practices. That was a necessary requirement of teaching online and looking at alternative assessments. So the key question, and what I want to talk most about in this presentation, is what happens next? We know that the pandemic will have a lasting impact. So what? So what does this mean for us? And so we're seeing, what I see in the data are three emerging trends that I think are going to keep us going forward. I'm going to just review these trends a little bit and then talk about the implications of them and the challenges of these trends. So we certainly see a trend towards technology, flexibility, and accessibility. So in talking about technology, what we're seeing in some of the data that we've collected, is, especially in the Canadian context, is that there will be increased technology use regardless of mode of delivery. So even faculty and instructors that are going to be teaching back on campus in an in-person setting are planning to increase their technology use. Some of the ways of teaching, particularly the use of, which I'll talk about in a second, video-based communications or having something recorded and posted on a learning management system, you know, using and accessing digital open educational resources in their practices, there'll be that use that's going to be increasing. And that's regardless of whether instruction is being delivered online, being delivered in person, or being delivered in a hybrid setting. We're seeing, certainly in Canada, institutional investment in resources to support teaching and learning online. So that may look like upgrading technology infrastructures to be able to accommodate more online engagement, having a more robust learning management system. And then also, it looks like hiring instructional designers and hiring staff who are knowledgeable and well-trained in online teaching and learning, and hiring those to centers of teaching and learning. One of the things that we've seen over and over is this trend toward video-based communications. And that can be both synchronous and live video-based communications, such as having a Zoom lecture, or it may be one-on-one, like changing office hours from requiring students to drive down to a physical office to meet, you know, face-to-face with a professor, that they can now conduct office hours via Zoom. We also see that as recording lectures, posting things online, having those asynchronous video-based communications as well. But that came up over and over. And the use of widely available technologies. So that comes up again as well in when we talk about accessibility. So these themes of technology, flexibility, accessibility are overlapping to some extent. But in terms of institution cost and in terms of the burden on the student and on the faculty member to have the technology, there is a trend towards using the technology that people already have widespread access to, you know, rather than requiring everyone to get, you know, VR headsets. As exciting as some of the XR technology is and the potential that exists within that, it also needs to be balanced out by what can the average student afford? What can the technology infrastructure support? If they're learning from home, what internet capabilities do they have and what type of technology that can be supported? So again, it's that leaning on what's widely available. As we go into flexibility, I put the word new for new modes of learning in quotation marks because as many of us know, we've talked about these modes of learning in our field for many, many years, but in terms of just broader academia, these terms are new to many people. This is the first time they've had conversations about this, particularly when we're looking at concepts such as high flex learning. So to clarify, like when I refer to hybrid learning, I'm talking about a mix of partially online learning and partially in-person learning. It may be the online piece may be synchronous. It may be asynchronous in terms of like a flipped classroom where someone's watching videos and then discussion. It may be that there's an in-person session and then an online session. So hybrid learning I refer to as just that mix of in-person and online, and it can be delivered in a number of different ways. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of creativity and flexibility and interest in mixing, finding different mixes of in-person and online learning. The difference between multi-access and high-flex learning, of course, which we're really seeing a strong interest in, but it's much harder to implement on the ground, would be where students can choose. So they can choose to attend in person one day. They could then the next day Zoom in, and all those options are available to them. And they can attend synchronously online, or they can just, you know, watch a recording afterwards, attending asynchronously. But all of those options are available to them for every single lesson, and they can move in and out throughout those. We also see faculty interested in remote working options, which is an important part of flexibility too. You know, as I mentioned, when we were talking about faculty with parenting and caregiving responsibilities, it's helpful and it's empowering for them to be able to work from home while, you know, with childcare. I know during the pandemic, women especially who are mothers experienced a major negative impact in terms of workforce advancement and workforce participation as a result of the pandemic. Because if the kids couldn't go to school for whatever reason, especially younger children, someone had to take care of them. And when you're able to work from home, you're able to continue to work while you've got kids at home. I certainly know for me personally, in my own context, even when school was back in session, as it was in British Columbia, where I live for much of the pandemic, for my kids, there was many days where someone would be, there would be exposure to COVID in the classroom, and I'd have to have children who were then at home for 2 weeks on self-isolation and couldn't go anywhere. And when we think about that for faculty, to be able to not have to miss work because they've got other responsibilities, but you know they can easily teach from home, that's an important thing to remember as well, because it helps us to have a more diverse faculty, which is really important. Flexibility also talks about pathways, and we are certainly hearing continued talk about alternative credentials and recognition for prior workplace learning, especially as we talk about what the future of higher education holds and where different priorities need to lie. And then lastly, with accessibility, there's certainly open practices and open educational resources, which are incredibly important for reducing costs for students, for making knowledge more widely available. And I think that there's a lot of people with much more specialization and expertise into OER who can talk in much more depth about how absolutely critical OER is for accessibility. equity, diversity, and inclusion is an important part of accessibility as well. And when the pandemic allowed us, and this is connected to the remote learning options, to address the fact that different learners have different needs. So one of the trends that we realized is that, for some students, online learning did not work at all. They really thrive, and it is much to their benefit to be in an in-person setting. So being online created a barrier for them. We also found the opposite as well. For some students, they thrived in the online setting, and that to be able to provide online learning options is huge in terms of accessibility. So it's important to remember, while online learning creates barriers for some, it also removes barriers for others. And that's one of the key, we're seeing that being more and more recognized as a trend, which is leading in institutions to having more online and hybrid offerings going forward. And we're seeing that regardless of the pandemic, that there'll be more online and hybrid offerings. And then the lastly is the access to technology. And I touched on that in terms of using widely available technologies. In Canada, we found even students who were in heavy, in major metropolitan centers, didn't necessarily have access to broadband internet, didn't necessarily have access to their own device to be able to learn online. So in implementing any online or digital learning option, we need to be mindful of the access to the technology and the burden on the students to have the technology that they need, whether that be devices, whether that be internet capabilities, in order to succeed in the course. And of course, tied in there as well, and more so in the, equity, diversity, and inclusion, is understanding, equal access to the ability to learn digital literacy, and being mindful of that people are coming in different places with that. So the implications of all of this, as we get closer to the Q&A time here, we've got post-secondary education is unlikely to return to the old normal. And I'm a strong, advocate that we're going to need to rethink how we do things. And that's my next point, is rethinking how we're teaching and assessing, because we're not going to go back to how things were in 2019. We might go back a bit to, having some similarities, but certainly we see that online learning and hybrid learning are going to be far more prevalent going forward. And there's that higher demand for flexibility and technology use than there ever was prior to the pandemic. We also see, that exploring new practices. So whether it's the rethinking teaching and rethinking assessment or exploring new practices, it's asking the why. Why am I teaching this way? And that's what we saw, faculty doing, especially in terms of changing practices. The pandemic, because it forced people to teach in a new mode of learning, it required that thinking on going, okay, well, why was I teaching that way? I actually found that when I taught like this, my students were more engaged, and isn't that interesting? And I wonder if there are other ways to teach or other ways to assess that might be more beneficial than what I was doing before. And there's that need in exploring new practices and rethinking teaching and assessment to share knowledge. That's been one of the exciting things that I've seen in the Canadian context, is a much greater interest amongst institutions to collaborate with one another, to share knowledge about what works and what doesn't. I did interviews with senior administrators about 6 months into the pandemic. And one of the things that I heard over and over is, I'm happy to share what's working for us. I would love to hear what's working for other institutions in this, as we figure this out, wanting to know what worked, what didn't, and how to overcome challenges. Which leads me into the challenges, because this isn't without challenges. This is exciting, especially for me, having been in this field. I'm sure for many of us in this field, that we get to see the things that we know are great about online and digital learning being more widely adopted and being put into practice. But at the same time, there are certainly very real challenges that need to be addressed. Our most recent, we've got a survey that's out right now with the Canadian Digital Learning Research Association, our national survey of online and digital learning. And the survey is still open right now, but the preliminary results are showing that one of the key, most pressing challenges is faculty burnout right now. You know, 2 and a bit years into the pandemic, faculty are exhausted. They've had a steep learning curve. They've done well. They've been, you know, concern for students was one of the forefront concerns at the pandemic and throughout, and making sure students were doing okay. So many faculty put their heart and soul into teaching, especially in those early days, but then going forward into learning new practices. And the pandemic, you know, it's also been hard on everyone personally. And so in implementing new strategies and rolling out new technologies, it's really important to remember that we're seeing a lot of faculty burnout. And that just needs to be considered in all of this. And, you know, is it the right time? You know, how do we approach that? Student mental health has obviously been an ongoing concern, and it's both addressed by having that online and in-person options. Some students are really feeling that need that they just really need to be connected in an in-person setting for that social connection. Other students, maybe they've got vulnerable faculty or family members, maybe they've got health vulnerabilities themselves, maybe they've got just some sort of challenge or a preference to learning online and where they thrive better in an online setting, learning from home. And so bearing in mind that both in-person and online contexts can support or exacerbate, you know, mental health problems among students, that's a critical challenge that needs to be, it's complex and needs to be considered. We're also seeing, although there's been a lot of professional development for faculty and they've done amazing given the circumstances, that there's still a need for further skill development and that know-how to teach online. So while we can say our faculty have done an amazing job through this pandemic, we're not yet at the point where we can say, you know, everyone is well equipped to do this, to teach online, to be successful in this environment. There's still a lot more learning that needs to take place, especially if an institution is considering rolling out a stronger online or hybrid learning program. Assessment continues to be a challenge. You know, the online proctoring, at least in Canada, did not go well. The decisions to do that soon were abandoned in many cases. And as alternative forms of assessment come in, which are in many cases, you know, wonderful and focus on, you know, what students should be learning and the why, there certainly are challenges, whether it be at the institutional level, whether it be in quality assurances, it opens a whole bunch of conversation and challenges and people buying in and, you know, what does it mean? What do students need to learn in this course and how do we actually measure that? And I think for those of us who have a lot of experience in the educational field, this doesn't surprise us that assessment is continuing to be a challenge. And then lastly, there's just the logistical challenges of offering greater flexibility. So when we see it on the ground, if we've got, you know, offering a high flex course where students can access in any way, that's great in theory. It is really hard for a faculty member who has to teach a number of students in person, not knowing how many will show up in person on a given day, while monitoring a live stream, trying to live stream themselves and engage with people who are attending synchronously online in real time, and then keeping, keeping some sort of touch point with those who are attending asynchronously. So flexibility is fantastic. It's important. And it also creates a lot of logistical challenges which need to be addressed. So the last thing as I wrap up, I think the next step we need, and this is one of the things I love about the Eden community, the group of people we're in, and I wish I could be there in person to chat more with you, with a lot of you over these dinners about this, but we are the ones who are the leaders in this field and have the ability to step in and provide that leadership and to dig deep into further research into best practices and just to continue to share our knowledge with one another and step in to support the broader academic community as they step into this new, this new era that we're going into, which again is exciting, but certainly comes with challenges. So that's it on my end. I've got my contact information there. I know I'm not there live, but I welcome any emails anytime from you if you want to chat further, if you have any questions. Certainly I'll answer some questions now. And then I've got my website, which has publications that particularly that I've done over the past couple years that are related to all that I've talked to. So Mark, you can help guide the Q&A because I'm not quite sure how this is going to work in the Zoom setting here.
Thanks. I'm not sure if I'm on the mic yet. If you're hearing me, I've returned to the podium, so at least our online audience can hear and see me. The latter is probably not as important. We do have some questions online, so I'm going to take a question from online first and then we'll come to those in the room here. Also, some of you may be interested, someone's posted online a link to a recent report, I think it was published last year, it may have been earlier this year, where you were referring to different evolving definitions of e-learning.
Yes.
But the first question I'm going to take, there are two questions actually on this theme, and it picks up on one of your challenges, one of the latter challenges that you were referring to. So let me just pull these out of the system here. So the first puts it this way, and then I'll pose the second verbatim as well. My own institution recently celebrated that we're able to return to campus-based exams. To date, there has been no sign that the status of the examination as a form of assessment is going to be fundamentally challenged. What's happening to traditional assessment practices in Canadian post-secondary institutions? The second version of that question is a little bit more concise. Curious to hear about the impact you feel the pandemic has had on assessment. Can you elaborate on what has changed?
Yeah, for sure. Those are great questions. I think one of the key things to understand about the Canadian context that makes it unique from any other country is the fact that we don't have a national, like our education is not governed at the national level, it's governed at the provincial level. So in many ways, education is almost like having, a bunch of different piecemeal programs. So some provinces have more, they've got, like, it's almost like a different culture per province. So you would see, for example, British Columbia, where I live, there's a lot of conversation about, assessment, alternative forms of assessment. We have BC Campus, which is very involved in online education, open educational practices, and spurring that conversation amongst the academic community. And that's different in different provinces as well. There's also institutions have a lot of autonomy, so it would depend on the institution in many cases. So some institutions are more progressive in terms of how they exams and being more open to alternate assessments and really questioning what are we trying to measure here? And there certainly is, there are institutions or, you know, even departments or faculty members who are, you know, just eager to go back to that traditional way of exam, you know, your standard 3-hour long form multiple choice exam. But I think the conversation is coming out more in the Canadian context, going, okay, well, why? And is that the best way to assess students? And I would say what I'm seeing in what's happening in terms of Canada is there's a lot more people who are starting to hold feet to the fire and saying, okay, well, why are you doing that, assessing that way instead of a different way? Let's look at alternative forms of assessment, how we can measure, you know, if our goal is to measure what students have learned, and whether they've achieved this, you know, this benchmark. We certainly have a lot of conversations here in Canada too with equity, diversity, and inclusion. It's important. And so that's coming into the conversation about assessment. And are those traditional exams equitable? You know, that's not necessarily the case in many situations. I think we also look, one of the key things are that's really being integrated in all provinces is Indigenous practices and recognizing colonialism and how that's impacting the way we teach and being open and willing to learn from the Indigenous communities about how there may be better ways that, especially when supporting Indigenous students, but many cases, those practices are beneficial for everyone in terms of assessing differently. So hopefully I answered those questions.
Thank you, Nicole. I'm going to now turn to the audience here in the room. I'm having to look out if someone does have their hand up. So if we could have a mic come over just while we're waiting for the mic, maybe a couple of responses around assessment. I've always felt that pragmatically, if you change the assessment, you change the student learning experience. I'm not sure if that's empirically accurate or not, but certainly the assessment was forced to change in many cases, and it's really that question about whether we go back. A question from the floor here.
Hi, it's Dietmar Kennepol. I'm with Athabasca University in Canada. So, Nicole, first of all, thanks. That was a wonderful presentation. I think you really captured what's happening in Canada, so appreciate that. Just a couple of personal, I guess, comments, and then I have a question at the end. Going into this pandemic and that, I saw like a lot of like our colleagues at, you know, non-distance sort of campus-based institutions do absolutely brilliant and creative things. But there has also been a lot of dreck out there too. I think you put a kind of a positive spin on it. And then coming back out, there are people who are certainly going to try, you know, other things, and their eyes have been open, but there's also people who just want things to kind of go back to the way they were. A couple of weeks ago, I was on a podcast on ableism, and I know you talked a little bit about EDI. And ableism tends to kind of is almost on the bottom of the scale on EDI when we have conversations about it. And what was interesting about the podcast, we had a couple of students there, and one student was at a major Canadian university, a law student, and was saying that she has a disability, and they would give the law faculty said, well, you can only learn law in person. But they would give exceptions to people because of Corona. And so she was in a situation where if she was suspected of having Corona, she could get a video or Zoom into the session, but because it was just a disability, she was not allowed to. So quite upset about that. Another student, that was a very particular thing, which I found very odd, but I think a more general one was there was another student there who was not just a student, but also worked in accessibility services at various universities and that. So I think hers is more a general case, saying that was so wonderful during the pandemic that these other options were there and I could actually flourish as a student. And then she started to, her voice started to tremble and she, you know, had tears in her eyes saying, and now they're telling me they're just so glad to go back to what's normal. And so I found that, you know, rather eye-opening. And so a lot of this stuff that I'm saying is anecdotal. I know you've been doing research on this. Can you, so the question part is, can you share with us how far along you think Canadians are in actually providing alternative ways of learning and or what the intention is? And I don't know if you've looked at, you know, institutions or provinces or individual faculty members and courses, but is there any indication of how much intention there is to kind of go back to normal versus going back to and looking at moving forward and going to alternative methods as well?
Yeah, those are great questions. I would agree with a lot. I definitely, in the great work out there, there was some not so great online experiences. And I think that that is really unfortunate because it left some people lacking. We've certainly heard that in terms of accessibility, in that for some students, you know, they really could flourish with online options there. And when I'm speaking to institutions, when I'm speaking to people who are developing policy, I really emphasize to them that this is, sometimes I find that the way to present it is sort of the bottom line. You know, when you're creating the online options that are offering more accessibility, you're opening the door to more students. So we're not going to lose the students. Like, it's important to have the on-campus options as well. And the students who want to return on campus, they will do so. However, when we open up online, you know, options, hybrid options, we're opening the doors to more students who wouldn't have come to that institution otherwise. And so I feel like, you know, in terms of the intention of, you know, going back to normal or not, in many ways that requires leadership from those of us who are in the field to explain this, you know, it's been a challenge for me to move away from sort of the passion, what I know in my heart to be the benefits of online learning and why this is important and beneficial, to take it to the bottom line from that institutional level, saying, okay, but this will actually increase student retention, increase student enrollments at a time in Canada, especially where we know that there's concern about loss of international student enrollments, and that student retention is a key concern as well. So I find putting it in that language, I think there is a mixed bag in terms of that intention to go, you know, to normal as it was in 2019 or to alternative ways of teaching and learning. I think there are some faculty who are eager to take risks, to try new things, to move to these alternatives. And there are certainly faculty who are wanting and very like firm in the ground to know there's like, you're not going to move my opinion. Online learning will never be as good as in-person learning. And I am, you know, there, that's a fixed point for them. What we would say, because you asked, you know, how far along are we in terms of the data and the research that we're seeing? What we're seeing is there's an increase, there's a shift in those attitudes. So while we still have people who are on that extreme end that, you know, their heels are dug in, that in-person learning is the only way, we're seeing less and less of that. We're seeing that shift in attitude towards more reception, receptiveness towards it, more of a willingness to try, more of an interest as well. We'll have, I know which I can, if you email me, I can send you the CDLRA publications. We released our 2021 report, and that had some data as well on changing attitudes over time. And I know we're assessing that right now for 2022, and we'll have some interesting data that we'll be releasing throughout the year as well.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room that's got a question? I'm going to take one online whilst the microphone finds its way around anywhere else in the room. So if you want to show your hand in the meantime, while while we're looking to see if there's another question here, there's, I think, a really good focus on, again, what you finished with. The question is, yay for the reference to leadership. Will you have any examples of or ideas about what form that leadership should take?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say that some of the things that I've done is, I think the more that we can, even speaking at individual institutions, finding out if individual institutions are having conferences, coming in as an expert speaking at those levels, at at the smaller level where you can chat with the institutional leaders. I think it's finding out, I know that there are some colleagues who have reached out to government officials in their province or in other countries nationally, who have said, okay, listen, whether it's the local government, whether it's beyond, and saying, listen, I want to introduce myself. I have expertise in this area. One of the key things that I found in moving the needle is anyone who's in a decision-making role, whether it's an administrator at a university, whether it's a policymaker in government, they are going to need evidence to back up any change. And so that's sort of where we need leadership, but we also need research, and we need those two things to go hand in hand, because we're gonna get a lot further as well when we can present it with some data to support it, which then they can justify, okay, well, we're making this change because it's supported by evidence. But yeah, I would say just look, I've tried to look within my network and seeing where we can, where I can have an influence and where I can be working to move the needle.
So I guess what I just a sort of commentary on the focus on leadership, and then we'll take a question in the room. We're not far off our end time, folks. In my own institution, I'm witnessing what I'm describing as the whitewashing of online learning as essentially a dirty word. As we return to campus, where real education takes place. So in my leadership role, I'm seeing myself as having to be quite subversive, and the political dimension should not be underestimated. But what I heard from Nicole was the multifocal focus. A question here from Matt.
Yeah, I have two questions. Mart Lanpere from Tallinn University, Estonia. The first one is continuing on the remark from Mark about political perspective. It happened so that last year I was asked to coordinate the development of a digital learning strategy for Tallinn University based on lesson learned from emergency distance education period. And one of the requests I received, let's say secretly from our administration, from the highest level of university administration, that could we also add one dimension to this strategy that explore in the process, because it was a very democratic process, involved, I don't know, more than 100 people we interviewed, and their practices and expectations and so on, getting back to new normal, And but the rectorate's wish was that to explore the people's readiness to actually go to this type of new normal with digital learning that would allow, let's say, roughly, as they said, we have 6 buildings in our campus, and could we envisage the future where digital learning would allow us in the future, after pandemic, to rent out one of these to businesses to save money? So it means to switch radically to blended learning, to cut the face-to-face teaching hours for each and every study program, so that they could actually rent out the whole building, 1/6 of the campus. So have you encountered some similar wishes from administrators in Canadian universities?
Yeah, we've heard that, and it's that sort of, you know, a matter of educating as well. I think the pandemic, at least in Canada, was good because it's a lot of the senior administrators that I spoke to, especially when I was interviewing them as part of one of our studies, the pandemic helped them to see that online learning isn't necessarily more cost effective, that there are actually a lot of costs that go into having an effective online program to offer effective hybrid learning. So I think there's that piece of it as well. So I would say that as a result of the pandemic, I think there's a greater understanding, at least, that it isn't necessarily a great way to cut costs. Now, cut costs in terms of, you know, infrastructure and things, what you were mentioning before in terms of faculty is a different story. And I think one of the biggest cautions, and when I'm speaking to people who are in those decision-making positions, is bringing up the point that what we're seeing over and over is the need for student engagement, regardless of delivery mode. And if we are, you know, if they're looking to be an institution, or if they're looking to implement policy that puts in strong, you know, online learning, or their brand, if it's an institution branding itself as being a leader in online learning, they're going to have to deliver it in a way that facilitates student engagement. And that's not necessarily going to be possible if you're packing in, you know, using the digital, you know, environment as a way to, you know, double or triple the number of students you've got in a class. And it's being mindful of faculty burnout too, that it's not going to end well with faculty who are, you know, who have the capacity and even the mental bandwidth to support a massive, you know, depending on the type of course, but an overcrowded course for whatever it is that they're teaching. And that's relatively subjective, because different topics and different courses would have sort of a different maximum for students in there. But I try to take the angle of, okay, well, you know, if we're going to want to keep the students, because again, when speaking to administrators, policymakers, I've got to shift it to that bottom line of student retention, then there's got to be high engagement. That's not going to happen in these overcrowded courses. But certainly, to answer your question, I think that's an ongoing battle of seeing online learning as a way to cut costs by, you know, overloading faculty, because we're not limited by the size of a room per se. So yeah, hopefully that answers your question.
Yes, thank you. I completely agree with it. And the second thing,
I'm going to be the timekeeper here, folks. Okay. It's just turned 7 a.m. for Nicole. It's 5 p.m. for us.
Yeah.
And I think we've had an insightful session looking at the perspectives and some of the research in Canada. And we've been making mental connections with our own experiences in our own countries and in Europe. So thank you very much. I think there is one question online that I'm going to pose for everyone as you're walking back to your hotels, or Nicole, as you're making breakfast for your three, I can't really call them children anymore, I think teenagers, children / young adults. But the question that's online, and I feel I need to just report what someone has written here to finish the day. I think it's an apt statement to finish the day. George Orwell once said, "Who controls the past controls the future." What do you see as the implications of this quote, if any, for the future of digital higher education? No answer required. That's for us to think about. I'd ask everyone to join me in thanking and clapping Nicole for the closing presentation. Thank you, Nicole. You can go and make breakfast for your children / young adults.
And I wish you all a wonderful conference dinner tonight. Thank you very much.